From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Star Wars turns 25 next week. George Lucas's outer space epic has come to be seen, for better or for worse, as one of the key cultural benchmarks of the last 30 years. It changed the way we look at films, espoused galactic hero worship, and turned Hollywood into an industry of packaging, merchandising demographics, and theme park attractions. It infiltrated our language and inspired a force-filled generation of pop culture.
If you only knew the power of the dark side, Obi-Wan never told you what happened to your father.
He told me enough. He told me you killed him.
No. I am your father.
Obi-Wan Kenobi. Now that's a name I've not heard in a long time. Long time.
I think my uncle knows him. He said he was dead.
Oh, he's not dead. Not yet.
Well, you know him.
Well, of course I know him. He's me.
Help you, I can. Yes.
I don't think so. I'm looking for a great warrior.
Great warrior. Wars not make one great.
Just you reconsider playing that message for him. No, I don't think he likes you at all. No, I don't like you either.
Use the Force, Luke. Let go.
Remember them loose. They're right behind me.
Almost there.
I can't hold them.
The Star Wars saga is action-adventure, women's romance, western, mystery, horror fantasy, and big-screen occultism, all in one vast package. In 1977, the very first Star Wars film was a box office epic that validated the sci-fi genre to skeptical Hollywood many-men. It showed bigger can be better and spawned a huge new industry in special effects. At a time when America was still reeling from Watergate in Vietnam, the apparently morally uncomplicated Star Wars gave a generation something to cheer about. To quote that great cultural commentator Bart Simpson, the only good wars have been the American Revolution, World War II, and the Star Wars trilogy. Yesterday, Attack of the Clones, the second film of George Lucas' second Star Wars series, was released at midnight showings to a new generation of fans every bit as rabid as their Boomer and Gen X parents. Have you seen the original Star Wars more times than your age? Beyond global infatuation with big spaceships and shiny swords, and we know there's a lot of that, what is the rest of this film's draw? What's the message of the Lucas universe? What is it about the Star Wars series that keeps you coming back? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me in the studio tonight is Garen Daly, film critic, owner of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts, and On Point's movie maven. Good to see you, Garen Daly.
Hi, Tom.
And also with us is William Brooker, author of Using the Force, Creativity, Community, and Star Wars Fans. Good evening and welcome, William Brooker.
Will, please.
I'm sorry. Good to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Will. Garen, what is it about this film? It's broken all kinds of box office records. I guess it's back up against the Spider-Man and everything else out there right now. But when it started out, it seemed fairly simple. And yet it's grown and grown. There's something at the heart of this. You know, there's a million ways to characterize it. Bruce Sterling, the science fiction writer, says it's a mongrel host of alien traditions under one sleek industrial facade. You just can't get more American than that. Why does this thing just keep coming?
You know, I was thinking about that, and I had to go back to when I first saw the film, which was in 1977 when I went to the trade screening. And the trade screening is before everyone else, before the public sees. And it's just industry guys. And I'm in there. And
so
I'm,
you were in the biz in grade school then, Garen.
Let's
okay,
not go
mind.
There. Anyways, I'm sitting in, and the buzz on this film is big. You know, and I'm a sci-fi nut. I've loved it. I read all the stuff back when I was a kid. Anyways, here's this really wonderful film coming up. I'm sitting in the second row, and it starts off. and there's this little spaceship going by a planet, and the planet looks real. And then this huge, huge spaceship comes coming, and it keeps coming, and it keeps coming, and it keeps coming, and it keeps coming. And I'm like going, wow, this is terrific. And all of a sudden, I am glued back to my seat. My head is up. My eyes are like saucers. And I am just loving this wonderful science fiction adventure film that is unfolding in front of me. And I saw it 3 or 4 times. In fact, I saw it again about 2 or 3 weeks later on an afternoon when there's nobody else in the place except me and his father and his kid. And the kid is sitting behind me. And he's telling the scenes, every single scene, to the kid. And I turn around and said, be quiet, be quiet. And he looks at me and he goes, it's a kid's film. And I'm going, no, it's not a kid's film. It just, I mean, there's something about it that just grabs you and holds you. And I think when we talk about it a little more, we're going to understand why it does grab us so much.
Part of the clue, though, is just in what you said there, how the planet, the spaceships just got bigger and bigger. There were special effects breakthroughs and always have been associated with Star Wars. That I guess, though it's hard to remember now, were really revolutionary for their time.
I'm not sure that they were revolutionary in the way that they were packaged, but a lot of the stop action motion stuff that he did goes back to King Kong in 1933. So the technology was there. He really just did a wonderful job of putting it all together in a new package.
Will Brooker, you've looked at the fans who take Star Wars to heart. Who is the Star Wars fan? I guess there must be many kinds of them, but how do you characterize them, and what is it that lodges in their mind and doesn't let go?
There are many different types of Star Wars fan. In my book, I talked to an 11-year-old who's a lot younger, 20 years younger than me, and he's completely into Star Wars as much as I ever was, and his first experience was seeing Return of the Jedi first. Then he saw Empire, which is very interesting for me because, of course, he knows the truth about Darth Vader before the cliffhanger, which you played at the beginning when Vader's like, I'm your father, and Luke's like, no, that can't possibly be true. So he's seeing him in the wrong order. Then he saw The Phantom Menace and was fine with that. No sense of disillusionment at all. No sense that this is Lucas losing it, playing to the kids like a lot of older fans have. And also there was a great deal of women involved in, very deeply invested in the saga. There are websites like Star Wars Chicks, which is a community buy-in for women who are Star Wars fans, and a great number of women are involved in writing Star Wars fan fiction too. But to get back to your question, I would say the main group is people like me, late 20s, early 30s, who saw it first when they were young in the 1970s.
And what is it that puts the hook in?
I can only really speak, well, I can speak partly for myself. I mean, I have a memory of when I was 7. It was just such a rush, you know, all at once. I'd been a cynic, actually. I was a kid cynic. Because everyone was talking about it. It came to my area of southeast London comparatively late, not in 77, but early 78. And my parents didn't want me to see it because they thought it was a bit too violent, you know, being a kind of nice, protective, liberal household. They thought I'd be scared of it.
Boy, if that's too violent, it's hard to live in Hollywood these days.
I know, these were the 70s. Maybe it's a more innocent time. So it was a while before I saw it, and all the kids were kind of talking about it. It was a huge, huge thing. I mean, people were aware that it was a big thing in America before it got to Britain. So there are national distinctions as well. So for a while, I was like, oh, I don't want to hear about Star Wars. You know, it's this thing everyone else is into. But as soon as I'd seen it, it was just like, for the next 6 years, that was the big thing in my life.
And now here we have it, a generation upon generation, 25 years next week since the first Star Wars film came out. Garen Daly, is there precedent for this, for a work or a series of films that keeps coming? It looks like it will be essentially for something like a lifetime.
I don't think that there's anything quite cinematic as important as Star Wars is. I mean, we'd have to go back into literature. And one of the things that a lot of people talk about is the fact that this is a new mythology for our generation or for our post-industrial generations, because we've gotten so cynical. We've spent all our time focusing on science, just science, and stripping away all the cultural and all the religious underpinnings of our life, so that Star Wars is addressing that myth and creating a new mythology by using a lot of the same techniques. When we start off in Star Wars, in the very first part, in Star Wars Episode 4, The New Hope, which is what I saw as originally as Star Wars, so it's a little confusing for the uninitiated.
It's the original, it's also Episode 4.
Yeah, it's the original, it's Episode 4. But anyways, it starts off with a very plain young man working in a farm on In a barren, brown, clean planet.
This is Tatooine.
Tatooine. And it's young Luke Skywalker who is lurking for greatness. He wants to do something. He wants to go on the great adventure, but he's stuck on this planet, stuck on the farm. He's stuck with his aunt and uncle, and he just wants to get out.
I think those new toys are going to work out fine. In fact, also thinking about our agreement, about me staying on another season. And if these new droids do work out, I want to transmit my application to the Academy this year.
You mean the next semester before the harvest?
Sure, there's more than enough droids.
Harvest is when I need you the most. Only one season more. This year we'll make enough on the harvest that I'll be able to hire some more hands, and then you can go to the Academy next year. You must understand I need you here, Luke.
But it's a whole other year.
Look, it's only one more season.
Yeah, that's what she said when Biggs and Tank.
Where are you going?
Looks like I'm going nowhere. I have to go finish cleaning those droids.
Oh, and he can't stay here forever. Most of his friends have gone. It means so much to him.
I'll make it up to him next year. I promise.
Luke's just not a farmer, Owen. He has too much of his father in him.
That's what I'm afraid of.
The first stirrings of Luke Skywalker's youthful rebellion in the original Star Wars, or Episode 4, whatever you'd like to call it, there he is. He wants to go out, and before he knows it, he's taking on the Empire, the entire Empire. It's been written that the whole series of Star Wars films, at least the earlier ones, are very allegorical, relating to George Lucas's life, that in Star Wars, Luke Skywalker and the Rebels take on the Empire. Here he was in the 70s, a California cinema hippie tackling the Hollywood system through skill, stealth, luck.
Yeah, you can look at that and say that that's what's happening, and I think we look at that in hindsight, but George Lucas was very, very conscious of what he was doing here. He was creating a myth, and he was basing it a lot on the Joseph Campbell Hero of a Thousand Faces, which is a story about an entire arc of what the hero must go through. And we can take a look at it and say, Frodo, Luke Skywalker, they both go through the same thing. Mm-hmm. Luke Skywalker has Obi-Wan Kenobi. Frodo has Gandalf. This theory of the arc in movies exists. It is something where not only do they have this mundane world where they break and they strive for greatness, but they also have to go through an early tragedy. Both his aunt and uncle are murdered, so it frees him from the choice of either staying there or not going, so he can go away. And there he meets Obi-Wan Kenobi. He meets Han Solo, another mentor of his, and he starts learning about things. And eventually he ends up going to see Yoda on Dagobah. And we can talk about what Dagobah means. And there he starts learning about what the Jedi Code is all about.
We're going to hear in just a second. I can hear Yoda's little feet pitter-pattering. Maybe we'll hear it after we take a short break because that's coming up. I don't know if we can jump into it too quickly. So, yeah, he's got his own mythology that he's developing. As you say, Joseph Campbell may have been an inspiration. Of course, Joseph Campbell was a very serious ethnographer and mythologist who studied myths all over the world. Do you think George Lucas was actively patching this together out of that book, or was just the received understanding of what mythology is from living in Western culture?
Lucas makes no bones about it. He considers Joseph Campbell one of his mentors, along with Francis Ford Coppola, who taught him about film. Joseph Campbell taught him about how to take the different strands of all the religions that he saw out there and weave them into this kind of force to create that Jedi Code that he became so famous.
Well, Brooker, we know that through history, mythology hasn't just been something off in the mist. It's been something very real and important in people's lives. Mm-hmm. Do you see Star Wars fans embracing this mythology as something real and present and guiding for them, or is that a joke?
Not all of them, but certainly some of them, yeah. I mean, I found that Star Wars fans embrace the saga in many different ways. Some of them, it's guided their career choice. There's a guy who joined the police force because he wanted to be like Boba Fett. People who've joined the American Air Force because they want to be like the X-Wing pilots. But there were some people who do, in place of traditional religion, follow what they think is the Jedi Code. And they see Obi-Wan, Qui-Gon Jinn, and Yoda as mentors. And they think, what would Yoda do in this situation of crisis? Behave calmly, be slow to violence, use defense only, restricted use of force.
There you go. What would Yoda do? We're talking about Star Wars tonight and how it has wormed its way into our cultural mind and heart, maybe the world's. Are you a Star Wars fan? What does it mean to you? What is the heart of the huge appeal of Star Wars? We're at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I can't. It's too big.
Size matters not. Look at me. Judge me by my size, do you? And where you should not. For my ally is the Force. And a powerful ally it is. Life creates it. Makes it grow. Its energy surrounds us and binds us. Luminous beings, though we, not this crude matter. You must feel the Force around you. Here, between you, me, the tree, the rock, everywhere. Yes, even between the land and the ship.
Feeling the Force with Yoda and Luke Skywalker. We're talking about Star Wars on the eve of its 25th anniversary tonight. What is the heart of the huge appeal of this movie? Why are so many millions drawn to this myth? Is it a good myth or a bad myth? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by our movie maven, Garen Daly, and by Will Brooker. He's author of Using the Force, Creativity, Community, and Star Wars Fans. Garen Daly, there's Yoda in that famous scene telling Luke to feel the Force, and ever since, you can't go through a week without somebody talking about the Force and the evil empire and the very language of Star Wars, and maybe more than that, has seeped into the way we perceive and share the world with one another.
You know, it's really true that the vocabulary of Star Wars has become our own vocabulary, and that's true of most of the really good films. You can take a look at Terminator and, you know, Hasta la vista, baby, I'll be back. We have a tendency to grab a hold of these. But, you know, there was something else in that little clip that we played that I thought was an interesting thing. When Yoda talks about the size of someone, and I think that when people of any size, kids especially, see this film, they understand that even though they may be small of stature, they have a lot of power. And that kind of reminds me again of something like, you know, Bruno Bettelheim's Uses of Enchantment, how we use myth and fairy tales to make ourselves feel comfortable in our culture. And I think little kids see that Yoda's a small little character who's very, very powerful, and they feel comfortable watching this film, and it makes them identify a little bit more with
it. You see him in Attack of the Clones. He's the only one who can take on Count Dooku at the end.
That's right.
I don't want to spoil it.
This is in the
any
new movie, and yeah. I guess people do know it, but Yoda pulls out his own lightsaber and becomes the battling Yoda.
Yeah, he's a warrior.
The strange thing about Star Wars as a piece of science fiction is that it is freed of the future, because we're told it's all in the past. All this high tech, super tech, you know, wild stuff, it's in the past. Bruce Sterling writes beautifully about this. He says, it is America all over. Flaming, tumbling aircraft, huge enterprises collapsing before they're built, earnest, rich young princesses pretending to be Democrats. It's beneath the special effects, there is a wild melange of philosophies and politics going on here. What are the politics of the Star Wars series? George Lucas, on the one hand, these rebels are battling against the Empire. On the other hand, there's a lot of hero worship here. This is kind of Nietzschean stuff, and it's not at all clear that he's really a Democrat at heart.
You know, when you look at it and you think that you've got princesses and you've got these royal barges and you've got an emperor.
And almost royal lines where the Force passes from father to son, kind of aristocrats of Jedi-ness.
Right. Well, and Jedi itself is an aristocrat. They're the aristocrat of the knights, you know, and knights. That was another thing that was passed on to generation. So I agree. It's not necessarily a democratic thing. But the setting and the time and place is important, because by putting it in the past and by putting it in a place far away, we can look at it with an uncritical eye. We can look at it without the 20th century scientific eye or the cynical eye.
Well, sorry to interrupt. People didn't do that with The Phantom Menace. It was accused of pandering to racial stereotypes, with Jar Jar Binks, Watto, and the Nemoidians accused of being stereotypes of black culture, Jewish.
Jar Jar Binks being sort of the step and fetch it kind of character.
Well, supposedly there, yeah, but I mean, Lucas was dismayed. He was shocked by this. So I think what we've got to remember is Lucas' intentions aren't always what the viewer pulls out from the movies.
Maybe not, except there is a lot of intent here. These are not random These are not random characters that he throws in, but he draws on a vast melange.
Yeah. Well, he does. And I think one of the things that I find interesting about Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones, in Phantom Menace, we're dealing with a bunch of merchants who start a war to get better and more powerful globalization going mm-hmm. on. Mm-hmm. And in Attack of the Clones, we really are looking at what is going on between man and machine. And this mm-hmm. is something that goes on in all the Star Wars. He is looking at, are we going to lose our humanity in the machines? Mm-hmm. And he kind of counterbalances that with R2-D2 and C-3PO as they're almost pets for the human beings. Mm-hmm. But in Attack of the Clones, you see armies of, and the same thing with Phantom Menace, armies of robots doing battle and everyone falling into little cogs being part of the big machine, a la Metropolis by Fritz Lang.
Mm-hmm. Always in the battle against Empire. I guess I wonder in the political resonance corner here, you know, if you've got to find the current parallel to the Empire, who is it? I mean, where does the U.S. fall in here? George Lucas comes out of hippie time. Is the U.S. the righteous rebels, or is the U.S. the overpowering Empire?
Probably both. Mm-hmm. And that dichotomy of things going on is bouncing around in Star Wars all the time. I mean, look at the relationship that Luke has with the different people, his relationship to Han, to Obi-Wan, to Leia. I mean, he doesn't even know who Leia really is at all. And all of a sudden he finds out that it's not what he originally thought it was.
Yoda spoke of another.
The other he spoke of is your twin sister.
But I have no sister.
Mm. To protect you both from the Emperor, you were hidden from your father when you were born. The Emperor knew, as I did, if Anakin were to have any offspring, they would be a threat to him. That is the reason why your sister remains safely anonymous.
Leia. Leia's my sister.
Your insight serves you well. Bury your feelings deep down, Luke. They do you credit, but they could be made to serve the Emperor.
The family dynamics go pretty thick here. Here's a brother falling in love with sister, and it gets sticky.
Yeah, and at one point, there's the thing that Luke and Leia may actually be in love with each other and have an affair. And of course, Han kind of mixes that up, too. So,
we're talking about Star Wars. How has it wormed its way into your life? Sarah's on the line. Welcome, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, my dad first took me to see Star Wars when the special edition came out, and I fell in love with it right away.
How old were you, Sarah?
Well, I'm 17 now, so I guess 13.
Okay.
And I just think it's like a brilliant fantasy, and I love the idea of the Jedis and the Force, and Princess Leia is so cool, and like everyone in it is so cool. And now, like, my younger sister is 4 years younger than me, and I've kind of like molded her into like a Star Wars fan too, and she's almost as big as one as I am. She's like my little Padawan learner.
Sarah, what does it mean to you to be a Star Wars fan? Is it a state of mind, or does it just mean you see all the movies?
I think it's kind of a, like, because you can see the movies, and that doesn't mean, like, it's just like getting excited when you hear anything about it. Like, I heard this on the radio, I was like, oh, Star Wars, like, get all giddy. Like,
it's Pavlovian, it's in the air, it's in the water. Sarah, we hear that excitement. Thanks for your call. The fans have gotten into Star Wars in a way that's kind of mind-boggling, to the point where there are even fan films, Will Brooker, that take off on the Star Wars theme and go with it?
There are some incredible fan films, yeah. During my research, there's things like Troops, which many people have heard of, I think which Lucas actually approved of, which is a kind of hybrid satire of Cops, the TV police documentary, and the scenes on Tatooine when Luke discovers that stormtroopers have killed his aunt and uncle.
And then there's one, I saw 5 minutes of this last night, and I guess that's about all it is, but it's Lucas in Love. It goes back, it's kind of a takeoff on Shakespeare in Love. It goes back to when George Lucas was supposedly first creating Star Wars. Before we hear it, tell us the real story, Garen Daly, of where did Star Wars come from? How was it composed? The first story?
The first story in terms of the mythology?
Well, didn't he begin working on it as a very young guy?
Yes, he did. He started working. When he first discovered film, when he was going to college, he came up with this idea and started working. He created almost the entire 9 episodes. He's only made 5 of them so far, but there's actually talk of a 9, 10, or was it?
I heard him saying today he was never going to do.
Never going to do that.
Seven,
yeah.
Eight, nine, yeah.
But anyways, it was something that was that he had worked on for a long time, and it had created in his mind not all the details, but a lot of the details. Mm-hmm. Now, this thing with Lucas and Love, which we're going to hear in just a second. One of the things that's happened in Hollywood is a lot of the up-and-coming filmmakers will make short films, and they need to find something that's kind of iconographic so that they can show it to other directors mm-hmm. and producers, and hopefully get a directing deal. And that's what a lot of the films are, like Troops and Lucas in Love, were made because they were using this as a cultural touchstone.
So in Lucas in Love, they have 5 minutes where George Lucas, I guess, is a college student, and he's trying to write. He's got writer's block. He wants to write something about star farming, space agriculture.
Wheat.
Space wheat. And instead, the whole story is suggesting itself in the world around him. Here he's talking with a professor you'll see who he sounds remarkably like.
It's not what you would call technically done. Yet, but it's about a young space farmer who is—he's struggling with a terrible crop of space wheat. Struggle. Yeah, and he's also searching.
No, search not. Inspiration will you not find. It will find you.
Could you talk kind of forward?
Too much already, have I said?
Lucas in Love, a short 5-minute film made by a fan of Star Wars, set in Berkeley, California in 1969 sometime. And here's an ersatz George Lucas talking with a professor who speaks just like Yoda. And of course, Yoda is what emerges in the final story. Oh my gosh, this is too much.
I don't think so. I love the fact that there is something that we can all, and I say we, anyone who's a fan, anyone who's seen this, we can all, just grab a hold of and run with, and we can talk about and discuss the many different points that are within it. It crosses all sorts of generations.
It shows how much it's part of our popular consciousness that film is so successful, because everyone immediately understands all the in-jokes.
That's right.
Let's reach out and talk to somebody who's really into Star Wars. I want to bring in Jerry Buat. Welcome, Jerry.
Good evening, Tom. How you doing?
We're real well. Jerry, as I understand it, you are a public relations officer for the New England garrison of the 501st Stormtrooper Legion. That's a fan costuming group? What does that mean, Jerry?
Oh, that's correct. Well, we're actually the premier Star Wars costuming group that you might find out there. And in fact, our costumes are of the highest quality, and some people have said they expected to see us walking right off the screen.
So you're dressed in that kind of shiny plastic armor of the stormtroopers?
That is correct. We have several members that have very accurate, extremely painstakingly accurate stormtrooper costumes, which are formed out of ABS plastic, actually.
Where do you go adorned in these costumes, Jerry?
Well, if I might, just give you a little history on the Legion. That might help to explain things. The 501st Legion was formed in and around 1997 by a gentleman named Alban Johnson, and it started with roughly two or three people who bumped into each other at conventions.
So it has its own mythology, we see, much like Star Wars itself.
Oh, absolutely. And much like Star Wars, it's grown to incredible proportions. We're now actually over 1,000 members spanning all 50 states and about 21 countries worldwide.
And you all have the white plastic armor?
Oh, we have much more than that.
Jerry, can I ask you something there?
Array of costume characters.
Here's a question from Will Brooker.
You just stormtroopers, like you do snow troopers, scout troopers, and clone troopers.
That's correct.
Are you clone troopers now as well?
Well, we're working on it. we've started to look at prototyping some of the helmets, and pretty soon we'll be pumping those out. But for our next few appearances, we'll still be our classic trilogy stormtroopers for a bit.
Okay.
So do you get together and do sort of marching exercises to like the masses and masses of stormtroopers we see in the Lucas films?
Well, most recently we actually got the opportunity to work for Wizards of the Coast up at Celebration 2, which was this massive Star Wars mecca, if you will, in Indiana, and about 180 of us assaulted the RCA dome and took a position up on the stairs and took this great photo. And we actually stopped traffic in Indianapolis for a few minutes while we accomplished that. But we're more focused locally as local garrisons such as my own, and we get together and do an awful lot to raise money for charities.
It sounds kind of tough, though. We know those menacing costumes. I see your I guess, website says, whenever Lord Vader's aims fall outside the realm of imperial bureaucracy, he calls upon the 501st to do his bidding. Sounds like a badass militia, Jerry.
Ah, well, you see, this comes back to the whole political nature of Star Wars. And, you know, I would kind of quote, if I will, you know, a famous Jedi in saying, you know, from a certain point of view, everybody's had the opportunity to see the Empire as the bad guys. But, you know, in all honesty, if I can get in character for a moment, you know, the Stormtroopers were the police force of the rightful government in place at the time.
Okay. We've got the spirit of that. Jerry, thanks for joining us, and may the Force be with you.
And also with you.
Jerry Buat is public relations officer for the New England garrison of the 501st Stormtrooper Legion. It's a costuming fan group of the show. So there it is. We've got fan films. We've got fans in costume. Will Brooker, there's fan fiction as well, is there not?
Yeah, there's a great deal of fan fiction, which falls into various generic categories, the most notorious of which is slash fiction, which I believe grew with Star Trek, grew out of Star Trek about Kirk and Spock having a relationship together.
Slash fiction. I'm not sure I want to know what you mean, but what do you mean?
Well, it's mostly about sexual relationships between characters of science fiction franchises.
So this is the porn wing of the imagination.
Well, you know, it starts at romance and it goes through to erotica, but a lot of the slash fiction around The Phantom Menace was about Qui-Gon Jinn and Obi-Wan, the two male Jedi.
Well, that will leave me far behind, but it sounds just as exotic as the whole film world.
Well, you know, I like to go back to talking about the mythology of this a bit. I think that when one of the reasons that Star Wars works so well is because we identify so much with the different heroes that are going on there. And it really works in the first, the classic trilogy, I guess is what you're calling it, you know, but when he gets into Phantom Menace, I think Lucas has lost sight of some of the mythology that he was trying to create. I mean, he ends up spending more time digitally with the characters rather than working the dialogue. If you take a look at Han Solo,
we're going to come back and talk about that. About this, it's often been said that there's been something lost on the passion front between the early films and the later films. As we go into the break, let's listen to another fan film. This one is an animated gangster rap music video about the original Star Wars trilogy. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Can I go to the Hashi station? I gotta lay away on the power converter. But now you're treating me like a scruffy nerf herder. Luke, who's the force? Run to Dagobah. Run to Dagobah. Luke, who's the force? Run to Dagobah. Run to Dagobah. I'm a soldier, a voted and voter. I thought I told you, don't be unwise, drink me that grandma's size. You won't believe your eyes, watch the X-Wing rise. Yoda, why you being a player hater? You know that I still must confront Lord Vader. But Luke, not really your new. But there's a city in the clouds where they keep up my crew. A Jedi's gotta do what a Jedi's gotta do. So now Vader, I'm coming for you.
I just set a course. We're going to Cloud City. It's a mighty good gin and tonic, which makes me up another. Things about to get ugly.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. If you haven't seen it yet, here's a clip from the latest Star Wars film, Attack of the Clones.
Annie, my goodness, you've grown.
So have you. You've grown more beautiful, I mean. Just being around her again is intoxicating.
Be mindful of your thoughts, Anakin. They betray you. You have made a commitment to the Jedi Order, a commitment not easily broken.
Please don't look at me like that.
Why not?
It makes me feel uncomfortable.
Sorry, Malay.
Must be difficult having sworn your love to the Jedi. Nothing able to do the things you like.
I'll be with the people that I love.
Are you allowed to love? I thought that was forbidden for a Jedi.
a clip from the latest, Attack of the Clones, and I guess there's Anakin who becomes Darth Vader, and he's falling for...
Natalie Portman, who plays Padme Amidala, who is absolutely gorgeous in this film. He does a very good job of creating icons that I think young people are going to enjoy, at least looking at, if not enjoying their...
Young men and older men will enjoy Natalie Portman.
Hey, well, I definitely enjoyed it. And I have to say, I saw the movie with my wife, and she enjoyed Hayden Christensen.
Right.
He does very nice, a good job of bringing those two generations together.
Karen Dilley, the other great sci-fi video experience, TV and film experience set in space, Star Trek. Star Trek, Star Wars, what's the difference?
Wow, that's a good question. I would say that in Star Wars, there is a more complete universe, one that's from start to finish is unique unto itself. Star Trek is essentially, you know, man in the future going out and kind of bringing his baggage to the universe as he bumps into other people. Star Wars is definitely a self-contained universe that we can enjoy as a myth and as a fairy tale and engage it in that way.
I stumbled into an amazing back and forth at Salon.com on this subject. And there, Star Trek is being held up as the real democratic show where, you know, cooperative effort is used to keep everything together, where people get too big for their britches, they get their comeuppance. And then Star Wars, on the other hand, they say it's all about elites. It's about they can inherit the right to arbitrate. Rule. Good elites act on their subjective whims without evidence, argument, or accountability. Any amount of sin can be forgiven if you're important enough. True leaders are born, it's genetic. It is amazing the effort people pour into debating the philosophies behind two science fiction stories.
And that's because we want to figure out why we all enjoy both of these things so greatly and so deeply.
Tony's on the line. Welcome, Tony. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was a student in graduate school in philosophy, and we did a lot of work with new forms of narratives, and a lot of the postmodern work is about little stories, that you tell little stories for people, like in Pulp Fiction, mm-hmm. where you essentially have three stories in one movie. And I think that the great thing about Star Wars is for the first time, we get a chance to go back to that epic, and we get to see not the Homeric epic, because it's not that high a quality, but it's still an epic. And we don't have an epic for our generation. And I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of people instantaneously identify with it.
So what can an epic deliver that a concatenation of short stories can't?
Well, first of all, an epic can show people how life works with an individual and how individuals grow. Whereas in Pulp Fiction, on the other hand, you essentially have a story that takes place over a period of 2 or 3 days, and somebody gets killed and something happens, and it's all neatly tied together, but it doesn't really show how people change and how life wears them down or how life brings them up. Mm. And I think that's something that we need to see in our generation, that, you know, people my age, 25, we're kind of looking for this. We get out of college and we're like, well, now what do? What does life hold for us? And I think that that's one of the things that an epic gives you.
It's a family saga.
Tony, thanks for the call. Will Brooker, clearly people are savoring the fact that this goes on and on and on. George Lucas promises at least one more, I guess, the sixth in the series. He says he'll be 60 when that's finished, and maybe that would be time to give it up.
I think, was it Tony there? Had a very good point. It is. It's going back to an old-fashioned kind of modernist narrative, the grand narrative, the big story arc. And I think that's partly why it's so much part of people's lives, because it's been carrying on so long. I mean, I first saw it when I was 7. You know, I'm 31. Star Wars has been a part of my life for like 24, almost 25 years now. And it's something we can grow up with. And it's like a family saga. It's the story of the Skywalkers. Anakin grows up, marries Padme Amidala. Then you have the twins, Luke and Leia, and they redeem Anakin when he's turned to Darth Vader. So it's a big, big epic sweep. And I think that's how people can draw lessons for life out of it.
There's something else here that I like about this. This is about fathers. I mean, it's a huge thing about fathers. And, you know, the fact that Luke is battling with his father, and in the Campbell world of mythology, you're supposed to slay your father. Joseph Campbell's mythology.
World of myth.
Yeah, you're supposed to slay your father, and that's how you gain to become an adult. Mm-hmm. But in Lucas's world, it is not a slaying. They work together to bring the Emperor down, who is the ultimate evil. And it is then that, you know, Luke enters the adult world.
Luke, help me take this mask off.
But you'll die.
Nothing can stop that now. Just for once, let me look on you with my own eyes.
Leave me?
No. You're coming with me. I'll not leave you here. I've got to save you.
You already have. Look. You were right. You were right about me. Tell your sister. You were right.
Luke Skywalker and the dying Darth Vader. Garen Daly, our time's gone too fast. Send us out on a stream of Star Wars trivia.
Okay. Did you know that Burt Reynolds was supposed to play Han Solo, but then he bagged out on it?
Thank heavens.
That the film is basically a remake, not a remake, but it's based on Kurosawa's Hidden Fortress.
Mm-hmm.
That Padme is Sanskrit for Lotus, and Yoda is Sanskrit for Warrior.
it gets thicker and thicker. I want to thank you both for being with us this hour. Garen Daly is On Point's movie maven. He's a film reviewer, critic, and owner of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts. And Will Brooker is author of Using the Force, Creativity, Community, and Star Wars Fans. You can go to our website to read an excerpt of Will Brooker's book and to see a photo gallery of Star Wars scenes. Log on to onpointradio.org. Coming up, a look back at this week's news. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. First, here are sounds from this week's news.
The reports are disturbing that we're finding this out now. I think what we have to do now is to find out what the president, what the White House knew about the events leading up to 9/11. When they knew it, and most importantly, what was done about it.
Had I known that the enemy was going to use airplanes to kill on that fateful morning, I would have done everything in my power to protect the American people.
After 43 years of feelings that are full of animosity, let's hope that in the near future you can extend your hand over that great division that separates our two countries and say, we are ready to unite ourselves to the community of democracies.
The agreement aims to slash nuclear stockpiles by about two-thirds over the next decade and is to be signed later this month when the president visits Moscow. Announcing the pact, Bush told reporters it will usher in a new era.
This is good news for the American people today. It'll make the world more peaceful and put behind us the Cold War once and for all.
I bear all the responsibility. There's always mistakes in every movement, in all over the world.
We have removed 1.8 million tons of debris. That's 100,000 truckloads. We have put in 3.1 million person hours of labor. We have also done it way under budget and much faster than anybody ever thought that we could. But we want to, on May 30th, have a ceremony to say thank you to those that at great risk have worked together so that we can help those that lost loved ones to the extent humanly possible.
And there's a week, House Minority Leader Dick Gephardt raising questions about what the White House knew in advance about 9/11 and President Bush defending himself. Jimmy Carter speaking in Cuba. the U.S. signing its new nuclear pact with Russia, a fairly quiet week in the Middle East, Yasser Arafat saying he's made mistakes. And finally, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg looking forward to May 30th when the last remaining steel beam, the last bit of rubble, will be carried out of the World Trade Center site, marking the end of almost 9 months of recovery work. Jack Beatty, we hear Dick Gebhardt there saying what he wants to know what they knew and when they knew it. These are ominous words in the American political lexicon.
Yeah, those are Howard Baker's words, not Howard Baker's words about Richard Nixon and Watergate. A real cheap shot there, I think, in that usage by Dick Gebhardt. But we now know that the intelligence failure, which thus far we've seen is limited to the FBI, the CIA, and the rest, went right to the very top of the government. And that there has been a cover-up, or at least a refusal to reveal what they knew and when they knew it.
The Democrats have been looking for a crowbar. Is this one, Jack, that you think Americans will welcome if they really shove it in and try and work over the Bush administration with it?
I think they better drop that crowbar and just let the press carry this and let these leaks. This came out as a leak. There'll be other leaks. Let the press deal with this and just stand back and have their hearing and have that hearing be impartial and just get to the bottom of this. I think any effort to try to score points is going to be a big, big mistake.
Yasser Arafat stepping up today, this week, and talking about his mistakes and talking about reform.
Yeah, who would have guessed that the first consequence, or one of the first consequences of the Israeli incursion, would be that the Palestinian Authority would begin to reform itself and that there'd be a movement toward democracy.
And a lot of it's self-generated from within the Palestinian community.
From within the Palestinian community itself, meetings where people are saying, we can't go the way of these suicide bombers, we've lost so much, we have to reform, we have to change. This is quite remarkable, and I don't know that anybody predicted that this would be a consequence. Or at least put it this way, that this would follow on the Israeli incursion.
Cold War echoes this week, Jack, with the U.S. Signing a nuclear pact with Russia that almost doesn't seem important anymore, though of course it is. And at the same time, Jimmy Carter in that old Soviet ally state, Cuba.
Yeah, I mean, just 20 years ago, you know, the big issue was putting Pershing missiles into Europe, NATO facing off with the Soviet Union, and now we have Russia becoming a sort of adjunctive member of NATO. Really, the world has turned, and it's turning in Cuba. That's what President Carter said tonight. He said, despite what President Bush is saying, policy change is at hand. He said that he met with 35 of the Cuban dissidents and asked them, President Bush wants to give you money. President Bush wants to restrict further travel to Cuba. What do you think? And they said, he said, we need more travel. This human rights in Cuba needs Americans down here, and don't give us any money. That will just deprive us of legitimacy in the eyes of the populace.
But Jimmy Carter, once again, with his sort of Gandhi style, going out into the world, Jimmy Carter style, and making quite a ring of the bell.
He really did, and we were very proud to be able to practically give simultaneous translation, thanks to Fred Tice on our program.
That was a fun night, and then it is. Somehow, just a silencing thought to think of the last bit of refuse or remains being taken away from the World Trade Center at the end of this month.
Yes, and what an unquiet grave that is for so many. I mean, just in the news now with, you know, what could have been, what might have been, what should have been. These people are never going to escape from that sort of thing, I'm afraid.
And that memory will never escape us. Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us. Have a great weekend.
And to you, and thanks.
On Point is produced by Tim Skog, Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Nate DeMeo, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Darren Manoogian and Jamie Kirchick. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Have a great weekend. This is On Point.
This is W.